Let's sing and swing.
Evening visit with Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt.
2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon in Manila.
And now we bring you Forbidden Diary, the true World War II story of Natalie Crowther, based on her secret journal written from a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines. Episode 11, Close Calls. Previously on Forbidden Diary.
Out of nowhere, we learned that Nakamura was promoted to run Tarlac Prison Camp. He left today.
Any news about Rufus?
The Filipinos think he died from being tortured the day he was taken in, but it's still speculation.
A Chinese man was reported missing before roll call by his own people. The guards quickly brought him back and began to torture him.
We're all set. I can get KGEI out of San Francisco and the BBC.
Jim can't be reporting this stuff in the newsletter like he's Edward R. Murrow.
Then some sort of word-of-mouth system?
And now, Episode 11.
The 4th of July, 1942. Someone whispered that an American flag is being made with red, white, and blue fabric that came in with some clothes. It is hidden until mañana comes, but ready, and we will feel we had a part in it. On the 4th, we usually watch a parade. Jerry plays golf at the club, and we join him for a sandwich. But this year, we're celebrating with a back-to-nature adventure. I can see Jerry and the kids from the window as they walk along the skyline above camp, with Jerry naked to the waist, June in a light blue blouse, and Beattie in a dark shirt, silhouetted against the blue heaven. They're heading into the wet jungle forest to hike down a canyon near a palisades covered with growth, where Daddy fells trees with other men on workdays. They should be back in a few hours.
Mommy, Mommy!
Well, how was it?
Oh, Mommy, we had the whole place to ourselves, but we kept wishing you were with us.
We went to the meadow at the top.
You could see all the way to Baguio.
There were wild strawberries.
We just sat and listened to the birds for a while and hiked down to the cave.
It's got a bunch of stalagmites.
Stalactites.
Daddy and I got bit by leeches. Wanna see?
We'll dress for supper and toast freedom with 2 inches of home-brewed basi, which is a rice liqueur. 1 inch of that stuff is enough to make me feel like Planter's Punch and the ruins of old Panama. I am hoping that some of the men don't celebrate too thoroughly with the basi. The other night, they could be heard whooping, throwing things, bellowing, and arguing about Australia. Some were long in quieting down, and it was remarked that there may be no more packages from town because of the outbursts. July 7, 1942. We haven't heard much from our new commandant, Henry Hayakawa. Everyone who has lived in Baguio knows him as the son of a prominent businessman. What a change after Nakamura. Hayakawa is younger, a more sensitive type, better educated, but not as mature. School's been in session for close to a month. The high school curriculum includes Latin, German, French, Spanish, Japanese, English, algebra, geometry, trigonometry, general science, biology, reading, and chemistry. Fortunately, we have a lot of qualified people in camp. Jim says 127 of us have college degrees. One man is writing his dissertation for a PhD in here.
Camp Holmes Daily News. The Camp Holmes High School will make its own bid for recognition in the world. Of its unique features, there is no doubt. What other school, for instance, can boast of an Alger story in reverse? From dean of a university college to janitor of a high school, C. Heflin is now on the way up again, having been made proctor. with certain disciplinary supervision added to his duties as building superintendent.
Our principal says she could write a thesis on how Camp Holmes School gets along with only one or two books that are passed around in turns. There's no ink, limited pencils, and scraps used for paper. Classes are held in the bedlam of the dining room with kitchen pans clanging, cooks yelling, and baby scraping and banging from above, not to mention the sounds coming from the alley. When the dining room is being scrubbed, students meet on the porch or garden, dashing in and out of the rain. Noise, confusion, every kind of obstacle, but all overcome. We adults are entertained with weekly lectures. Phil Whitmarsh gave one of his best talks on African wild animals this week. Dr. Skirl lectured on geology, and the flower arrangement class started by Nakamura continues. Japanese is taught by Miss McKim, one of the missionaries who arrived from Manila last month. She's the daughter of the Episcopal Bishop of Tokyo, who was born and raised in Japan. She speaks the language with precision and beauty. Japanese soldiers and officers respect her aristocratic accent and call her Honorable Aunt or Oba-san when they want to converse with her. Miss McKim's thorough understanding not only of Japanese and English, but of the customs of both cultures, has made her Camp Holmes's interpreter and diplomat. July 8, 1942. Jerry fried out some pork and gave me some of the crisp remains. It tasted so good, and I was so hungry that I cried over it and couldn't talk. He fried up some rice with the grease, and June and I ate it with our fingers. Jerry understands how I feel emotionally wrought up over meat with real flavor. He says the woodcutters feel the same way on the hill at noon. We took a walk beyond camp and found the most glorious free view, more sweeping than those from camp. Only the mountains are untouched by invasion. Clouds trailed into each valley and indentation, piled in huge heaps like snow. The rice paddies in the distance were full of water, like glass. Beautiful, quiet, and detached. We saw six Igorot women with full baskets on their backs hiking down a narrow trail toward their home. Then a boy and a water buffalo. July 10, 1942. A plane dropped leaflets, and Hayakawa posted one of them for all to see.
Now, what's it say, Phil?
Nothing. Just more propaganda. The Japanese want people living in the hills to surrender. Love this line. It is very much regrettable and sympathy-worthy not only for such remnants in particular, but also for the people of the Philippines in general, that they are obscuring the sound development of the Philippines.
That word's only a lawyer can understand. What the hell are remnants? Is that supposed to be us?
Saan mo nakuha yung flyer?
Binibigay lang nila ito sa Session Road.
What do they mean by remnants, Ismael?
People who haven't surrendered, Nida. The Japanese want the guerrillas to hand themselves in.
They're not going to do that.
I bet you Walter Cushing got under the Jap skin.
He was a miner up in Abra before he became a guerrilla. Did you know that?
I thought he was in the army, Jorge.
No. Not at first. He recruited 200 Filipino miners back when the Japanese invaded Lingay and Gulf.
They ambushed a truck convoy and killed 60 Japanese. He's a demon. He ran up to them with a pistol in each hand.
And sticks of dynamite hanging out of his pockets.
Yeah, yelling, give it to them, boys.
He's killed 500 Japanese and blown up 1 million bridges.
They're never gonna catch him.
Man, those guerrillas are like ghosts. They ambush the Japs and disappear up the mountains. They're driving them crazy.
That's why they dropped that stupid leaflet.
Did you know that Cushing's recruited a bunch of Filipino soldiers?
Did they desert the army?
No, some coronels made Cushing a captain.
So he is in the army.
Hey, did you hear the one about the Filipinas serenading him and the Japanese officers walking by? Cushing hid while the girls sang God Bless America. And the gagos applauded.
Oh man, I love that guy.
Ah, mga gago.
Ay. I think he's crazy.
Ah. He's in Manila now trying to get money for the resistance.
He was in a nightclub there and a Japanese soldier recognized him. So what does Cushing do? He walks straight up to the guy and tells him he'd been released from prison for the day to visit the hospital.
Man, he's got guts.
That's what's gonna get our country back, my friend.
Well, he'd better do it before the food runs out. There were food riots in town because no one can afford the prices. And with typhoon season coming, it's just going to get worse.
They're replacing English with Japanese and Tagalog for government documents.
How about replacing everything with Tagalog? Some new East Asian order. Where are we in all of it?
Nowhere.
After the invasion, a bunch of rich Japanese locals put their names in a hat and divvied up everything. That's how Mr. Nagatomi got the Pines Hotel and Mr. Hayakawa got Hickok's supplies.
And we're living under the boot of Kempeitai and hiding our women and girls from Jap soldiers.
Our girls have to dress as boys?
That's where we figure into Japan's new order.
At least, we're not as bad as those poor American GIs imprisoned at Camp Hay. Have you seen them at the market?
Yeah, they're a mess. Really thin and dirty, wearing rags.
The Japanese are using those GIs to convince us that America's lost its power.
July 15, 1942. Dr. Lee had a baby boy. She told me that Nakamura came to see her before she was even out from under the ether.
Oh, he was so proud that I had a boy. My neck, shoulders, and arms ached from nerves after the delivery, so Nakamura stayed an hour and massaged them. You know, I'll never forget the strength in those carpenter fingers relieving my aches. I think he literally poured strength into me.
It turned out that there was no job for Nakamura at Tarlac Prison, so he returned a few days later, subdued and silent, with no job, no house, no place for his family, and broke. He had not been paid for his time as commandant, so Dr. Lee offered her house to Nakamura and his family, if they can get permission. A bag arrived on the delivery truck from Nida with raw pork chops, mangoes, toothpaste, chow chow pickle, and pineapple. That girl is inspired. But how does her family manage to live? The day also brought good news that was circulated word of mouth around camp. Tokyo, Yokohama, Osaka, and Nagoya were bombed back on April 18th. 13 U.S. bombers hit manufacturing centers. At Midway, 27 ships were sunk or damaged. Coral Sea, the same. The Japanese lost 270 planes on sunk carriers, the U.S. only 4 ships. In the Solomons, occupied by the Japanese, the enemy lost 254 planes in a week. We also heard that the Philippine Islands became a member of the United Nations. There are 28 countries in all now. July 16, 1942. The rainy season has begun. No washing on the lines or mopping, but more time to talk, read, and study until it clears. The men say that it is fine weather for guerrilla activity. July 17, 1942. Jerry sent an urgent call to meet, so I went out into the gusts to drink half a cup of coffee at our meeting place behind the back stairs. His big brown eyes were serious, his face gray, as he told me the news.
Mommy! Daddy's calling for you.
Oh, I'd better go see what he wants. What's wrong?
One of the woodsmen escaped over the hill.
Who?
It was Sai.
When?
During work duty.
And you're the one who's going to be punished, aren't you?
I'm the group leader, so the target's on my back.
How could he be so selfish? Did he give any indication that he was going to escape?
In hindsight, I suppose. I mean, he's always griping about something. But you could say that about a lot of people. Nah, I'd say that he kept his plans to himself.
Oh, Jerry.
I'm gonna send my things over to you just in case the Kempetai gets involved.
You really think it's that bad?
It might be, sweetheart. We've been out here too long. I'd better go.
As it turned out, the guards took Sai's escape equitably enough. By noon, it seeped around camp that intelligence had found us such model prisoners that no action would be taken this time. But if it happens again, punishment will be drastic. There has to be more behind this leniency than their explanation. High Command is probably too busy with the increased guerrilla activity we're hearing about. 4 months ago, they would have acted at once. July 20, 1942.
Camp Holmes Daily News. Good old Camp Holmes, the place whose motto is every man for himself and best things for those who can grab the most.
Boy, oh boy. Truer words were never written. Everyone in camp's involved in some sort of graft. The kitchen crew, the lumberjacks, wood haulers, hospital staff, garbage duty, and now, me. I grabbed an old army coat from a garbage can, which was probably looted from Camp Hay and tossed out by someone moving into town. Despite mends, patches, and holes, it had months of wear left in it, so I gave it to one of the men working the garbage wagon to trade. He came back with 3 bunches of bananas, payment from an old Igorot sitting by the roadside who welcomed the coat. So now it's giving warmth and pleasure, instead of being at the bottom of an ash heap. Come to think of it, thanks to graft, we now have a workshop. Jerry gave me the grand tour. Wow! This place is like something out of a Swiss Family Robinson novel with all these homemade gadgets.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You can thank the firewood crew and the looting Parsons for most of this. And you know, I gotta give the devil his due. Nakamura let us bring over the tools and supplies we pilfered at Camp A.
What's this contraption?
A buffer. It's made from a piece of fire hose.
Well, isn't that clever?
The polishing grid is residue from a grindstone. We looted the jeweler's rouge.
That's a cute pin someone's making. What's the heart shape made of?
Coral. The spades, diamonds, and clubs are made from silver.
Where did they get that?
From the trophies we borrowed from Camp Hay. This emery wheel came from there, too.
That's a forge over there, isn't it?
Yep.
Is that where you made our frying pan?
Yeah. The floor of the charcoal burner was made from an old road roller.
The door looks like it came from a safe.
Uh-huh. An army field safe. Remember the ones out on the field when we first came here? See, all these chisels, awls, and punches were made from firing pins and rifle sights. Nothing goes to waste around here.
That workbench looks familiar.
It should. It was the serving counter at the mess hall.
And here I thought there was nothing left to loot.
There's always something to loot around here, darling. I'm saving the best for last. Follow me.
Where are we going?
You'll see.
Okay, what is it?
It's a still.
So this is where the bussy comes from.
Uh-huh. The pressure cooker's made from a fire extinguisher. That firebox was a gasoline drum. And the cooling system's made from the end of a steel reel, some copper tubing, and a gasoline tin. Makes pretty good hooch.
Well, it sure packs a wallop. I can't take more than an inch of that stuff.
I know. Come check out the stockroom.
Jerry, this is just amazing.
Everything's inventoried, from worn-out light bulbs to these old inner tubes. Sai used some of this stuff to make an army belt to carry his tomahawk and bolo. He even added a first aid kit and a carrying pouch.
And now we know why.
Yeah, well, that was a close call for sure. We got lucky on that one.
I wonder where he ended up.
Probably hiding up somewhere in the mountains with his Filipino wife. Hey, Phil. What are you making there?
Mrs. James asked me to etch her prison number on a piece of bamboo.
That's quite ornate, Phil. It'll make a stunning brooch.
Think that you could make something for my favorite girl here?
I can carve a stone for you, Natalie. Or put your name on a steel mirror.
How would you do that?
With this electric writer. It's made from a nail point, wooden handle, and a small coil.
How do you power all of this equipment?
Well, the wood crew supplies us with gasoline and oil.
But where do they get that?
Wherever the opportunity presents itself. Right, Phil?
Tano qui invenio.
Yep, finders keepers. Our camp motto.
Sounds better in Latin.
How about if I etch it on a mirror for you, Natalie?
July 28, 1942. After supper, I found a bag on my bunk from Nita and Carl. In it were three raincoats, two pairs of shoes for Jerry, an umbrella, towels, and four enamel plates and four tin spoons. No one in America can know the importance of such everyday items. Those plates and spoons will take us out of a long waiting list for dishes. We put our names on them with precious adhesive tape, just like Jerry's frying pan. Our figure 9 teapot made at the shop from an oatmeal can has also given us independence from borrowing. Nita also sent a Red Cross box with the last of the supplies sent from Manila during the invasion. In it were the towels, surgical coats, and hospital gowns sewn in our garage by faithful Filipina women throughout the air raids. There were also 50 yards of linen toweling and sewing supplies, including 8 spools of white thread, which are worth their weight in gold right now. The box's miraculous appearance gave me almost as much of a thrill as handing it over to the committee, who presented me with 4 hand towels and a pair of scissors to replace ones taken by the Japanese. After the contents had been distributed, Peg swung by my barrack space with additional items, things I had forgotten about and not even asked for. Oh, hi, Peg. What do you have there?
The committee found some things in the Red Cross box that they want you to have.
Oh, that's not necessary. They've already given me towels and scissors.
I know. But these belong to you. Here.
Those velvet cases sure look familiar.
They should. They're yours. Go on, open them up.
Oh, Nita packed the miniatures of June and Beatty that their godfather gave us.
And here's a box of pencil leads. Nita must have wanted you to have them as well.
August 7, 1942. It's been a week since the tragic confirmation of Rufus Gray's death. He was one of the missionaries detained during our first month at Camp Hay. Rufus was killed on March 15th by the Intelligence Special Service of the Japanese Imperial Army from third-degree questioning and torture. On the day of his funeral, Jerry, the kids, and I took a hike up the mountain. As we sat near a baby pine and looked down into the valley, a gong sounded in slow, mournful beats, calling church members to gather for Rufus's memorial service. There were prayers and scripture to give comfort and sympathy from all to the strong hearts left behind, the minister said. Rufus Gray's young widow stood bravely in the group, her long months of uncertainty, agonizing doubt, at last ended.
If she could have been on the rim of the hill instead of in the valley, she would have heard their voices rising to the heavens, to the Creator, even to Rufus himself, who is beyond all mortal suffering now. August 8, 1942. News from the outside has resumed, with several authentics circulating through camp. 125,000 people were killed in Dusseldorf raids, with 50,000 injured. America and Britain have delivered an ultimatum to Germany that all of her cities will be bombed like this if she does not stop the war now. Dreadful. Horrible world. Because the US is getting so much news from the Philippines, the Japanese are trying to track down American and Filipino communication lines. It is said that somebody outside camp hears broadcasts every week in Tagalog, Ilocano, Visay, and even in Ibanag from the US to encourage the Philippine Islands. Within 3 days, a happening here is told back at home, showing contact by radio, both receiving and sending. Yesterday, in a deluge of rain, Dr. Dean went to town for special surgical instruments. About 10 p.m., he operated on Paul Thorson's brain to relieve the terrible attacks that became so severe that 4 men had to hold the patient. They found much fluid and inserted a drain, finishing about 1 a.m. I have not heard any other facts other than it is a tumor. Our lives are so close in here that the illness of one life touches and saddens us all. Everyone is quiet and depressed. August 16, 1942. Our camp committee held elections for new officers a few days ago. It still surprises me that the chairman does not want the women to vote or have any kind of election. Instead, the general committee appointed the women's committee and allowed women to contribute ideas to the men's suggestion box. The chairman thinks any other way would end in what he calls a mess. Well, the Japanese don't consider women people anyway, so it is all one piece. Perhaps there will never be any official democracy in here, except for the men. Even though the election has come and gone, Jerry says that the losers are still binding their wounds over at the men's barracks.
That whole election stunk on ice. I made 42 frying pans for people and only got 8 votes.
I didn't even get a vote. All I got for making 48 coffee pots was 8 cups of coffee.
Yeah, well, that's nothing. I made 200 beds.
Well, what were you running for? Frustrated Don Juan?
Well, you don't have to run for office for that.
August 17, 1942. It is a strain on the sex instinct to be so near and yet so far. Numerous petting parties have been going on lately, which accounts for the guards pointing flashlights in odd corners of camp every night. They are lenient about daylight commingling, but in this setup, there isn't much use stirring up the emotions beyond a certain point. One man was reprimanded by Arthur and the guards for being in the women's barrack. So many take advantage of the leniency that we may end up with no more commingling again. As it is, couples may play bridge in the evening, and there is pleasant mingling in the dining room. Why some men have to be smart and brag about how much they get away with is just another one of the human mysteries. August 21, 1942. The truck came in from market with stacks of plates and cups, for which we had implored weeks and months ago. In the truckload was a precious packet of birdseed. I don't know who was more joyous, us or the little canary dipping in his birdseed. But late afternoon, when I was dunking mops, I heard my name called loudly. Arthur was looking for me because I was wanted at the guardhouse. Oh, my heart did flip-flops like the day Cy went missing. I hung up the mop and handed the bucket to Beatty, who wanted to go to the guardhouse with me. Arthur and I talked in low voices on the way over. What's going on?
I haven't a clue, Natalie.
Did they send for Jerry, too?
No, just you.
Maybe it's about our sponsors wanting to get us out.
I don't think so. Evidently, there's a package for you.
It was less than a week since our last package from Nita, so I could not imagine who it might be from. The guard pronounced my name and looked me over. Then, in front of Arthur and Miss McKim, who was there to interpret, he portentously cut the string securing the package in front of him. We craned forward to behold a luscious pie with sliced bananas and grated coconut on top. "A pie. A pie," the guard repeated, and then handed me the package. It was such an anticlimax that I wanted to shriek with laughter and flushed crimson trying not to do so. People were hanging out of windows and watching from the front porch as I came back, calling out, "What was it?" And it sounded so absurd to say, "A pie." Arthur later told me that when Inez, our lovely Igorot friend, and two other girls came to the guardhouse, he tried to impress on them that it was dangerous and that they should send food using the truck that goes to the market. In these times of guerrilla suspicion, anyone knowing or contacting Igorots, even by pie only, is suspect and put on a blacklist. This was our second close call this summer, and we were lucky again. But I worry that our luck with the whims of the Imperial Japanese Army may not be as favorable in the future.
This concludes Episode 11. Be sure to tune in for the next episode of Forbidden Diary, the true World War II story of Natalie Crowder, based on her secret journal written from a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines.